So without further ado, introduce Priya, Priya Day, who is an activist at the University of Queensland. Priya, I've been working with Priya on a campaign against the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, if you know about that appalling right-wing think tank that's trying to set up degrees for Western civilization on a bunch of different campuses around the country. And Priya has been central to waging the argument that at UQ, the setting up of this degree would be a breeding ground for the far right on campus. And that the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, who includes such racist figures as John Howard, Tony Abbott, Joe De Bruin, a whole bunch of other hard conservatives, these people are actually fascist enablers, and their rhetoric is not that far removed from the Christchurch killers in his manifesto. And they've just led an amazing rally just a few weeks ago now to put a spotlight on why the university administration is accepting this racist degree. So make Priya feel very welcome.
Cool. Before I start my talk, do people maybe want to shimmy to that side of the seats just so everyone can actually get in? Alrighty. Give people a second to do that.
Yeah. Good idea. Apologies to the live stream.
Yeah. Alrighty, now that we're settled. So Brenton Tarrant, who was the fascist murderer in Christchurch, titled his 72-page manifesto The Great Replacement. And in a series of terrifying, psychotic passages, he proclaimed that white people are dying out, being colonised by Muslims and refugees who are taking over the West in a tidal wave. And by murdering 50 innocent Muslims, Tarrant saw himself as taking the survival of his race into his own hands, and he hoped to inspire other people across the West into similar vigilante action. In both Western and non-Western societies, it's a key ideological and organising tool for the far right to construct identities of persecution amongst groups who are very far from held down, such as whites in the West, Hindus in India, men and straights in general. And this imagined victimhood is used as a rallying cry to whip up fascist cadres into a hysterical, paranoid frenzy, which is then mobilised against people who are actually oppressed. So in this talk, I'll debunk the politics of white victimhood. I read their vitriol so that nobody else has to do that again. And there are three recurring arguments that I'll debunk. The first is that the far-right argument that when oppressed groups or minority groups campaign against inequality and for civil rights, they're actually trying to gain unfair advantages in society over white people. The second is the theory is putting it very generously, like the racist vitriol of the Great Replacement, which is popular all throughout the West. And thirdly, the conundrum posed by people like Lauren Southern and others: why is white pride racist while black pride is not racist? The key takeaway from this talk in some ways is very obvious, that fascists are racist and their ideology is very illogical. And obviously I'm preaching to the converted on this question, but by unpacking fascist ideas, it does make it very clear where they come from, and that points to what strategy we need to defeat them, which I'll talk about at the end. So on to the first theme in the politics of white victimhood. It's a meme that fascists cry white genocide in response to any campaigns against racism and inequality. Their argument is that in fighting for civil rights, pathways to employment or education, black people, migrants and refugees are trying to get handouts and we're just one leg up over whites in society. And this particular idea is not a particularly new one. It's got iterations in fascist movements and far-right movements from, you know, way back in the 30s. But I'd argue that the contemporary iteration of this idea has roots in the post-racial and colorblind ideologies that have been popular amongst governments in the West, particularly in the UK and the United States, but to a lesser extent in Australia, following the class struggle and radicalism of the 1970s. In that framework, the government framework, racism is a thing of the past. So Jim Crow has been lifted, white Australia is a thing of the past, slavery is over now, and multiculturalism and equal opportunity now reign in race relations. And according to this narrative, nobody is held down on the basis of their race anymore. Racial discrimination is a sad blot on history that society has progressed beyond. Colorblindness dovetails really nicely with neoliberal pro-capitalist ideology, because the idea is that if you're facing hardship in your life, don't blame societal structures, but look inside yourself for the cause of that. And in reality, racism is still firmly entrenched in capitalism. Far from disappearing, it has intensified in the neoliberal age. We don't enter the market or society on an equal footing. Indigenous people in Australia are still the victims of land theft and dispossession. The United States is still essentially segregated, and you only need to look at the emergence of Black Lives Matter under a black president to show that, because Barack Obama is held up as like an example of post-racial society in some way, anyone can make it to the top, but that's clearly bullshit. And over the past 20 years, Western governments internationally have demonised and curbed the civil liberties of Muslims all throughout the West to justify murderous wars in the Middle East. So how does the far right square the circle of racism in a supposedly post-racial society? Well, firstly, they blame the oppressed for their oppression. Sometimes the far right deals in total conspiracy when it comes to racism. So they'll say any talk of people being held down is fake news, refugees are really millionaires, that's part of the dialogue. But sometimes if the far right acknowledges that there are differences in the quality of life between certain groups of people, they attribute that to the merit and the personal qualities of the people involved. So black people are the victims of state violence because they commit more crimes. Indigenous people are more likely to be poor because they're lazy and so on, whereas white people have an entrepreneurial spirit that's ingrained, stuff like that. And in this meritocratic framework, campaigns against inequality, like fighting for subsidised access to housing or education or higher welfare payments or just basic civil rights, it looks like migrants trying to deprive white people of their hard-earned social position. Internationally, fascists use this logic to champion as the as the true champions of equality, as against lefty social justice warriors who secretly want to oppress men and whites. For example, David Duke, who is the former, former head grand wizard of the KKK, founded an organisation, the National Association for the Advancement of White People, as a counterweight to the historic civil rights group, the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People. And explaining the purpose of this group, Duke said, "The NAACP, for the Association for Coloured People, promotes racial discrimination by seeking discriminatory policies against white people in employment, promotions, scholarships, and in college and union admittance." Whereas the NAAWP, the white one, seeks equal opportunity for all. So that's how they pretend to be the real ones for equality, because if you even acknowledge the existence of racial discrimination, that's in some way, unnatural. So the second way the fascists square the circle is that they recognise the existence of racial oppression and they think it's a good thing. They think it's a natural thing. While claiming to be for equality, the far right do actually believe in ideas of biological differences between race. According to this framework, white victimhood is the outgrowth of struggles for black rights and civil liberties, which have disrupted the natural-born and appropriate right of whites to rule. And this explains why the international far right is so obsessed with white South African farmers, because using this method of claiming to be oppressed when other people resist discrimination, the South African far right have successfully engineered an international myth that they are the victims of white genocide. Far right outfits, they are outrageously called civil liberties organisations in the mainstream press, like the group Afrikaner Forum, have toured the world meeting with political leaders. Their most high-profile date was with John Bolton, who was Trump's former national security advisor, to reveal the truth that the rainbow dream post-apartheid is just a lie, that the blacks have been given political power and white people, white farmers, you know, the heirs of the Afrikaner spirit of conquering virgin land and toiling the harsh earth are being murdered and actually at risk of dying out. Afroforum claims to be just innocently representing a racial group like any other group might do, but they're a far-right political outfit and their whole purpose of existence is to kick up a fuss whenever there's a campaign to redress inequality in South Africa. That's everything from substantial things like land redistribution to things like renaming street signs or knocking down statues of apartheid-era colonial leaders. That is their role. They also, and if this isn't an example of, you know, equality and multiculturalism, I don't know what is. They also help to fund two white-only townships in South Africa, which fly the Transvaal Republic flag. And if you enter them, you're greeted by people, like the people in the registration book are wearing, like, old-school Afrikaner military outfits. So it's some deeply bigoted and right-wing stuff. And the international far right wants to shed a tear for the South African farmers because it validates their idea that black people are just unable to stomach or to deal with having political rights. In reality, there is absolutely no genocide going on in South Africa. It's very, very far from that. White people are still disproportionately represented in institutions of power. At the fall of it, there's a lot of stuff about the land in South Africa. I think this statistic shows the most clearly how crazy this idea is. At the fall of apartheid, 80% of privately owned agricultural land was in the hands of the white minority. Today, it's 73% of privately owned agricultural land. Far from rights for blacks going too far, you'd argue that not nearly enough has happened to redress the racism that is so central to capitalism in South Africa. And in general, South Africa has a very high rate of violent crime. That's an outgrowth of terrible poverty and inequality. But the wider you are and the further you live away from the city, the safer you're likely to be. So Tony Abbott last year said that 400 white farmers had been killed last year. And that Afriforum group made a prediction that 21,000 white South African farmers were going to be murdered this year in the supposed genocide. But the South African police statistics say that 62 people in total were killed on farms in South Africa last year. So that stat isn't divided into race. It doesn't say what someone was doing on the farm. Were they a worker? Did they own it? Were they just visiting? And it doesn't say how murder took place. Was it domestic violence or a random killing or whatever? So all of this stuff about white South African farmers being oppressed and facing genocide is a total bizarro fantasy land conspiracy. But then what else is new when it comes to far-right ideologies? They sometimes, the way they position is that they have a really bizarre interpretation of a concrete policy, so that affirmative action is genocide towards white people. But other times they just deal in pure fantasy. Just look at, you know, anti-Semitism, the prevalence of that in far-right thought for such a long time. it is a paranoid fever dream that a cabal of Jewish bankers is secretly controlling all of global capitalism's financial institutions. And yet this has been the result. This idea has resulted in, you know, how many countless horrors and deaths over time. Okay, so a second theme running throughout the politics of white victimhood is that white people are dying out. The father of this idea is, or one of them, is this French fascist, Renaud Camus, who wrote a book called The Great Replacement. This is the more intellectual-sounding and a palatable version of white genocide. And there's different expressions... There's different expressions to this concept. So Camus argued that by their behaviour, by their growing attachment to their cultures, manners and religions of origin, have become, with a few exceptions, invaders, conquerors and colonisers. This is quite similar in some ways to an article that Andrew Bolt wrote for The Australian last year titled The Foreign Invasion, where he lamented a tidal wave of immigrants sweeping away what's left of our national identity. And it's not very new. Pauline Hanson in 1997 wrote a book called The Truth, where she warned that if immigration continued at the current rate, by 2050, Australia's Prime Minister would be a lesbian Chinese Indian immigrant, which would surely signal the collapse of Australian society. So those are some explicitly far right, expressions of some kind of white replacement. But there's, it was talked about at the panel on the far right last night. In the last year, two Labor leaders in New South Wales have made comments to this effect, from Luke Whiteflight Foley to what's that other guy's name? Daly or something? Michael Daly, saying that Asian people are stealing jobs from hardworking white people. This is the reason I say that this is the more intellectual sounding and palatable version of white genocide, is that it's just patently not the case that there's a large-scale mass killing of white people going on in the West. They can't even really get away with it when in some faraway country like South Africa. It's very obviously not happening in Australia. But the great replacement idea is that immigrants and refugees are slowly infiltrating and taking over, the different institutions in Western society. And because they won't reject their cultures and languages and traditions from where they come from, and because refugees are flooding European shores, migration is through the roof, and there's a very particular and horrifying obsession with the birth rates of white women being too low in the West. And again, the concept of the Great Replacement is absolute fantasy land garbage, but I think that the way we should respond to this is, before saying white people are absolutely, definitely not dying out in the West, we should say there would be nothing wrong with having more brown people in the West than white people. When I was doing research for this talk, I read some shocking smaller liberal stuff, some New York Times pieces, which were full of population statistics and demographic statistics, essentially to appease the idea that white people are being replaced, which is totally gross, because we should just say that there's no problem with having more brown people around. That's not a bad thing. Race is a social construct. It's not like insects imposing on a really delicate ecosystem, so we need a fine balance. That's just racist garbage. And we should, the Marxist starting point is obviously rejecting the idea of racial and cultural purity as either something that exists, let alone something that needs to be defended. Everything about human society was developed through interaction and change. After establishing this, it's absolutely not the case that white people are dying out in the West, and I don't need to talk about which race is breeding faster to make this point. Far from immigrants and refugees constituting a privileged layer that is starting to dominate in Western societies, immigrants in general, and non-white migrants in particular, as well as refugees, Everywhere in the West, super exploited, oppressed and scapegoated. White nationalism is firmly entrenched in all the state and cultural institutions throughout the West. Immigration is a bit of a contradictory question for the top end of town, because on the one hand, all throughout the West, but in Australia particularly so, capitalists rely on tremendously high rates of migration to sustain the labour force. So they're not for shutting the borders. They need lots of people to come in. But simultaneously, it's very good for them to demonise and scapegoat migrants as shirkers and deviants and so on. And this is, yeah. So, and that's that. And essentially they pass policies about migration and the conditions of life for migrants once they've actually, you know, reached Western shores, that condemn them to lives of insecurity, from migrant workers slaving away on 457 visas in Australia to so-called undocumented workers in the United States fearing being stolen away by ICE in the night. And this insecurity reaps lots of profits for bosses, because people who are desperate will work for wages and conditions that people who aren't quite so desperate would not be as inclined to. And immigrants are a convenient piñata to beat for the shortfalls of capitalism. Everyone knows the tired racist refrain, migrants are stealing your jobs. Dutton's recent comments are particularly, following the Medevac bill, are particularly just like naked scapegoating, naked divide and rule. He's argued that money spent on refugee detention has meant that age pensioners have had to do without, and that if refugees are let into Australia for medical treatment, those will be hospital beds that I think he said servicemen or something can't take up. It's a classic tactic. It's pinning blame for the government's cruelty and the capitalist class's cruelty on the most oppressed and downtrodden people and desperate people in society. And to say that refugees are in some way privileged or infiltrating is just such a fucking joke. I think Justin Eckers-Chacon or someone described it last night, that the Mediterranean Sea is just a mass grave now because of refugees, the refugees dying just trying to seek safety. And Muslims are a particular object of obsession for the far right. Renard Camus makes this theological argument about why we should be worried about Muslim migration, because Islam prevents the mixed mingling of cultures, and therefore they couldn't possibly assimilate to French society. And so in turn, he calls for an anti-colonial rebellion against the invaders to send them back to their countries of origin. So what is the logical conclusion of that kind of hatred? It's what we saw in Christchurch, obviously. So the politics of white victimhood is expressed by some of the most powerful institutions in society, you know, the state, the government, and so on, to ramp up the oppression of people who are very, very, very desperate, like immigrants and refugees. And while the mainstream far right... while the mainstream far right, demonizes immigrants, while the mainstream right demonizes immigrants and tightens, border security policies and so on, the far right can take this to, you know, horrible conclusions on the streets. And as well as being racist, there's a very pungent misogyny underpinning the idea of the Great Replacement. Mm-hmm. Sexism and fascism go hand in hand. The Great Replacement is, in some ways, the mother of all scapegoats for incels, because it brings together a hatred of migrants and of women, because the sexist element goes, why are white women selfishly out there working when they should be breeding our next of kin, you know, keeping our great civilization alive? How dare they demand abortion rights and murder the white children who we so desperately need for the survival of the white race? Like, it's just so disgusting. It's awful to say that stuff out loud. Okay, and the final theme manifest in the politics of white victimhood is that whites are denied the right to celebrate their culture and their history. And this idea encapsulates the politics of the previous two themes. So it's a reaction against anti-racist movements, and it's a total fever dream of erasure. So the Canadian fascist Lauren Southern held international tours last year promoting the slogan, "It's okay to be white," because apparently, again, those oppressive social justice warriors have made being white a bad thing. Being anti-racist is actually, frothing at the mouth bigotry towards whites. The argument goes, white people are blamed for all sorts of bad things like colonialism and war and genocide, as though there was never a war in China. And so white people should shuck these oppressive demands to be ashamed of your cultural background, say white pride, because detractors be damned, there's lots to be proud of in Western civilization. That's the fascist or far-right argument. And just the expression of this idea just shows the racist heart of white pride, because it's a furious response to demands of the oppressed for their rights. White pride and white power are actually expressions of white supremacy, where the slogan black pride is like it's a rebellious thing. It's a sort of a slogan of resistance against racial subjugation. White pride is a celebration of precisely that subjugation. So Marxists reject all forms of nationalism as a cancerous tool which exists to rally workers behind their ruling class. So we can oppose proletarian internationalism to ruling class nationalism. But that being said, there are very important distinctions between nationalism that's expressed by people who are oppressed and nationalism that's expressed by people who are oppressive. So Palestinian nationalism is based in rejecting genocidal Israeli apartheid. Vietnamese nationalism in the 1970s was based on repulsing the US military. Whereas Australian nationalism, that we're just the lucky, plucky country, papers over the genocide of Indigenous people, this country was built on, the unequal class divisions and the torture of refugees and all the rest of it. As does United States nationalism, and all of this provides the ideological justification for countless crimes against humanity in imperialism. So ideas of black pride are, it's like rebuffing attempts by the ruling class to break the confidence of people who are oppressed. So Black Lives Matter was about saying, fuck racist police brutality. We acknowledge that it exists and we're not having a bar of it. Whereas All Lives Matter is just denying the existence of racism in the state. And white pride is racist because it's celebrating the oppression of other people. And the articulation of white nationalism is an attempt by the far right to mobilise and beat down on other people who are resisting the things that are holding them down. And generally speaking, the white pride stuff is pretty crude. It's just like someone says something anti-racist and white pride is the furious response to that. But it becomes way muddier and more racist when the topic comes up of what exactly you're meant to be proud of for being white. And there are very mainstream, again, articulations of this idea. So Harsha at the beginning mentioned that I'm part of a campaign, which is really a national campaign, against the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization. And the Liberal Party's argument for this centre is that there's nothing racist about celebrating Western civilization because there's also an Indigenous studies unit. But their concept of Western civilization is totally ahistorical, it's totally fraught, it's a political category, it's synonymous with this made-up white history that's supposedly representing an uninterrupted legacy of democracy, liberty, fraternity and so on from the ancient Greeks to the modern day. And the implication of studying things like democracy or whatever as being Western is that the Orient, the Arab world, the unwashed masses of brown people are just backwards and have always been and remain more backwards and culturally, politically behind Europeans. And obviously, this is just such crap. Like I said before, everything about Western civilization or Eastern civilization, all the world was made not in, you know, hermetically sealed boxes of cultures and races, but through interaction, through class struggle, through change, through chops and changes. And the concept of like a unified white people does not exist in the way that the far right wants it to. The expression of being white has in the West always been associated with being in a position of sort of cultural dominance in society. So there's all sorts of groups of people today who are considered white or can be considered white who were not so 100 years ago. So the Irish is a key example of that. Jewish people at different stages, Greeks and Germans and Italians. This is absolutely a political concept that is connected to a political dominance and supremacy. And so that when the far right from, fascists on 8chan to the Ramsey Center for Western Civilization argue this thing about like an eternally and constant good white society or Western people, it's just using a really constructed and false version of history to make the arguments that excuse what they want to do in imperialism essentially today. Okay, so I've broken down, for that reason it's very right to say fuck Western civilization, and it's very right to say that we are for the suppression of like white pride. We are for the cultural suppression of some kind of white identity emerging because it's based on oppression and it's not at all the same as the other things that I've described. Okay, so I've broken down why the idea of white victimhood is just nothing more than a deeply racist fantasy. But a question that people might have is, why the hell does anybody believe that this stuff is true? And to understand fascism or how can far-right, deeply racist ideas get a foothold in society, you need to understand the role of racism in a class-divided world. So the far-right in recent years has grown off the back of racism being peddled by mainstream politicians. As speakers at the recent national rallies in solidarity with Christchurch Muslims put it, racist politicians loaded the gun. And the key similarity is that capitalism relies on racism for its existence, and so does fascism. So capitalists and their political agents require various forms of racism to pursue their interests, you know, to get away with the theft of indigenous land, whether for the very establishment of this country or to secure mining operations. Today, the government has had to dehumanise pedophile rings. People might remember that the Northern Territory intervention was justified on the basis of cracking down on supposed pedophile rings operating in the NT, which did not exist at all in reality. To justify the murderous wars in the Middle East, Muslim people, the ideological barrage against Muslims has been non-stop for 20 years. That has more than that, really. It can take the form of racist newspaper articles like Andrew Bolt's, but it's also things like Operation Hammerhead in 2014, when the US government and state coordinated raids on Muslim families supposedly to foil terror plots throughout New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland. There was no terror plot to be foiled, but they just whipped up hysteria because they did it. Because it was like, if the state is invading people's houses, surely there is some problem. And it was, again, all based on bullshit. Like, there were images of the cops walking out of someone's house holding a sword, which was a plastic sword, you know, it was just an ornamental sword. But all of this stuff, the state's activity and the rule, and contributes to ideas of racism towards Muslims proliferating throughout society. So fascists then accept these ideas and then they expand on it. So they accept the justification for the war on terror that radical Islam is a dangerous threat that we need to challenge. And then they take it to one step further to a horrible conclusion that we need to carry out violence against ordinary Muslim people and drive them from our beaches. They accept the tenets of white nationalism, you know, the foundation of Australia, that the ideal Aussie is a thong-wearing, you know, barbecue-having, beer-drinking white suburban family, and that we all have shared values of democracy and liberty, whereas those migrants don't fit in, so we should exclude them, we should push them back from our societies. And this is not to say, so there's a very clear link between the racism peddled by the mainstream and the far right taking and then expanding on that in ways that are not exactly what Luke Foley was calling for example. But this is not to say that mainstream political parties, capitalists, the far right and fascists are just undifferentiated. There are uneasy and sometimes antagonistic relationships between them. For example, the United States capitalist class, by and large, does not support Trump's proposal to build, to extend, rather, the wall on the border of Mexico, and they don't support large-scale deportations because the immigrant and undocumented workers are just way too important to the US labour force. And similarly, the far right was given confidence by Trump's election, but then they were equally spurred into action by disaffection with him, like the idea that he hasn't carried out the racist project he was elected on effectively enough. So Brenton Tarrant, again in his manifesto, wrote that he supported Trump as a flag bearer for white nationalism, but hated him as a leader and a policy maker. And the far right often pitches very antagonistically so those are sort of divisions within the right, but they pitch very antagonistically towards mainstream parties. So Camus blames Macron, who is responsible for the state of emergency that has terrorised Muslims in France for some time, for ushering in the so-called Great Replacement. Tommy Robinson in the United Kingdom has spearheaded sizable rallies of some thousands in opposition to the British state. He argues that the Tories, the Labour Party, and in particular the media are contributing to the persecution of white people by kowtowing to the European Union and so on. And so the far right and the mainstream right are not identical. So the mainstream politicians have normalised and nurtured the atmosphere that has allowed for the confidence building of the far right and the acceptance of their ideas in mainstream society. And what this, even though they don't agree with every tenet of what they then carry out. But the main conclusion of this, or the most important one, is it means mainstream politicians, whether from the, you know, the centre-right or the centre-left or what have you, are totally incapable of challenging the far-right because to do so would mean calling into question some basic tenets of their politics like borders, austerity, and imperialism. And so this explanation for the rise of fascism, and indeed like the methodology I've talked about the way that fascists position themselves, is applicable even when the fascists in question are not white. So, for example, I would argue, and one day I'll write something for Red Flag about this, that the largest fascist movement in the world is in India right now. It's Hindu nationalism and the Sangh Parivar. The Hindu nationalists argue that they are threatened by a Muslim takeover. Fascist militias are mobilised to physically destroy buildings that are associated with Muslims, claiming they belong rightfully to Hindus. There's been a process of the Hindu nationalists trying to rewrite the education curriculum to say that there is one unified, superior Hindu identity stretching back from pretty much pre-class society in India to the modern day. This is not the case. It's not the case with Western civilization. It's not the case with Hindu nationalism. And sometimes the far right mobilises and cracks down on any attempts by women, by lowercase people, to fight for their rights. And the state sometimes is very is totally okay with this. The Prime Minister of India was responsible for a pogrom against Muslims in Gujarat in the early 2000s, which I think killed about 2,000 people. He has blood directly on his hands. And sometimes the mainstream distances themselves from certain elements of it, censoring particular acts of violence. And I want to raise that particular example, which may or may not be familiar to people here, because it's just to contest the common idea on the left that racism is a result of it's white versus black. It's something inherent in people about the way we look, and that white people are racist because they're scared of losing their privileges. I just think that argument is it doesn't make sense in the world, and it's deeply objectionable because it gives way too much ground that there are differences between us based on the way we look, and that race is more than just a social construct. And it's flawed, like what defines whiteness, what defines blackness, and if there's something inherently oppressive about whiteness, does that mean there's something inherently submissive about blackness? Like, that is the natural and very disgusting conclusion of that idea. And if racism is just a product of contest between skin colours, then how do you explain racism between people who are both brown or not white at all? So it doesn't make sense. So what's a much better way of explaining racism and the far right and so on is rooting these ideas in class society, in the construction of states and nations and so on. So to sum up, all of this has consequences for how we fight the far right. Firstly, and obviously, given that fascist politics... I really like this because it's just such a simple placard and poster. Given that fascist politics are entirely based in conspiracy and nonsense, there's just obviously no point debating fascists. They're not going to be convinced out of racism by logic and facts because the whole premise of their hysteria is fundamentally illogical. Instead, the left just needs to outnumber them and break their confidence. And secondly, we need to do that every time the fascists have a rally. We need to get in their faces and so on. But if we understand that the far right and this kind of racism is not an aberration to capitalism, but an outgrowth of it, then we need a sustained challenge to racism generally. That means taking on imperialism, austerity, borders, the mining companies, you name it, all the politics, institutions and things that nurture and normalise the far right. And ultimately, the material basis for fascism is rooted in capitalism. This system needs racism, it needs oppression, it needs nationalism and division for its very existence. It's a system that's prone again and again to crisis, which unsettles all sorts of horrible elements in society time and again. So to defeat fascism for good, once and for all, it's at class society, it's capitalism that we need to call into question.